This is The Conversation. It's episode 156 with Sherman Sam. He is a London-based artist and art critic, or art writer if you prefer, Singaporean, born and bred. So he's a Singaporean living in London. He lived in LA many years ago. He lived in Oxford, and he goes back to Singapore regularly. So he is truly a man of the world. And so great to talk to. I think you're going to really like listening to this guy, our conversation. It was so great to be able to ask him about seeing shows, writing for Art Forum. He's a regular contributor to Art Forum. He also writes for Brooklyn Rail, Art Critical, Art Review, Ocula, which is a Hong Kong-based web publication. So great to get his take on going to see shows and what to cover, what he prefers. He also has been to many Venice Biennales, so, you know, he's really been around. And as an artist and writer, there's just so many interesting angles on that, which we got into. We also got into Singapore, so stay tuned for that as well. I'm Michael Shaw, by the way. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com, where I recommend you go get yourself familiar with Sherman's work, because I'm going to guess that you're not. And he's got a couple of shows coming up. We talk about that towards the end. But he's an abstract painter and drawer, and you can see shots of his work as well as his studio. Nice gathering of objects, books, and so on. His writing desk, and so on. So go check those out. This is the Sunday after the Saturday of the big opening night, around probably a good portion of the gallery hosting United States. So certainly here in LA, definitely New York, presumably maybe in Chicago, other cities where multiple collections of galleries have openings. And I'm going to guess that there were around LA roughly in the neighborhood of 30, maybe at the most 40 openings. I'm putting it closer to 30, though, as far as, you know, galleries that you actually go to, you could go to during the day. You'd add that total. The total would go higher with more alternative spaces and whatnot. But in any case, Culver City, which still has to this day, even though they have come down from their high, the biggest conglomeration of shows opening at once, had a big opening night kind of thing. And I hit sort of the tail end of it, but really saw shows during the afternoon, so kind of missed the gauntlet of it. But in New York, meanwhile, I read on social media there were 100 openings last night. So that, you know, is a lot to cover. I'd be really curious to hear from you if you are in New York and you went to a bunch of those openings. Let's say half or even close to half of them. I would be especially interested to hear from you if you are an introvert, like a pretty hardcore introvert, and you went to like 50 openings. You went to 50 openings, saw tons of work, tons of people, and then just crashed for like 3 or 4 days. So I won't be expecting to hear from you from like later this week, but I want to hear from you. I really am curious about how one marshals their psychological energy, wit, and emotions to go through something like that and then come out without, you know, just having to crash for a while. But we talk with Sherman and I, to get back to the guest, we talk about what shows to see, what that involves, you know, how he chooses, because he's going both as an artist and a writer, you know, so it comes down to supporting your art community, which you will hear him articulately talk about. I think you will like Sherman a lot. He was really easy to talk to, and I mean, he really knows how to have a conversation, so I think you will notice that. And stay tuned, please, for the back end, where I give an Instagram shout out, I give you the bad advice of the week, and so on. I hope you enjoy this. Thank you very much for being here, and I will talk to you more on the back end.
Sometimes it's a word, I very occasionally use it, and I'm annoyed with myself for using it, because it's become a kind of common usage, but I try and use the word play. Because there's yeah. No, I can't think of, or work, because yeah. That sounds more logical to me.
Yeah. I mean, you and I could have a longer conversation about that word and why it bothers us respectively so much. But I tend to inundate my listeners just in passing with complaints about it, and I don't want to bark up that tree unless I have to. So, I don't think with you it's necessary since we're both on the same page. You are in London, and that makes you my first London-based guest. So that's exciting.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
That's so exciting.
It is. I've spoke to somebody who is living in London still, but we spoke in Los Angeles in person, and now she lives in Los Angeles. So, and I think there have been candidates before, but it hasn't worked out. So, yeah, it is exciting indeed.
I'm drawing you up a list.
Fantastic. I look forward to it. And you are not only based in London, but in Singapore, which, you know, if we were speaking while you were in Singapore, that would be even more exotic. But there's just so much to ask about. And I think as much as I want to ask you about Singapore, since you're in London now, why don't we start there? How long have you been partially based in London?
I have been here. I've been in England since, I think, September of 1993.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in London since, I think, 97, 98. It has been about 22, 23 years.
And where were you living
after 20?
Where were you living before you were living in London?
I was in Oxford for a couple of years.
Did you go to school?
I did a history of art degree.
Wow. Okay.
I don't like to advertise it. I feel very embarrassed.
Well, you know, I think you anticipated one of my much later questions, which is your connection to Art Forum. And I, when you said Oxford and art history degree, I thought, oh, Art Forum probably really liked that.
I guess. I'm still baffled that I write for Art Forum.
Oh, is that right?
You know, it's still one of those. Every week, I think someone's going to fire me sooner or later.
Wow.
It's one of those things where, you know, when you read it when you're a young student and then suddenly you're writing for it, it just seems bizarre.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but it feels like to me.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a real sort of cryptic hierarchy, I believe, from what I gather, and we can get into that a little bit later. But since we're still on England, so you came over from Singapore to go to Oxford?
No, actually, it's a bit more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
I actually started in the Parsons School of Design System, and when I was a student, when I was in high school, I thought I would study graphic design and then be an artist on the side. But then I realized as I was applying to art schools, graphic design, it was actually more illustration rather than graphic design. And the one art school that offered illustration and graphic design as a major was Parsons in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied there. And then a long story short, I wound up transferring from I wound up deciding to do fine art instead of graphic design, and I transferred from Parsons in Paris to Otis, which was at the time owned by Parsons.
Right.
So, and then through another long, circuitous journey, wound up moving to Oxford to do a second degree in history of art.
Mm-hmm. So when you were in studying illustration and then graphic design, was that decision based on doing something more practical than fine art, or how did that work?
Yes, it was based on doing something more practical than fine art, and also I didn't actually get to study graphic design because, as you know, in the American system, you do your foundation year first.
Mm-hmm.
So I did my foundation in Paris and then thought, oh, but I don't want to be a graphic designer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then just switch to fine art.
I see. So, and that's okay. And that's what you did at Otis here in Los Angeles.
Yep.
Got it.
Yep.
Okay. And
so
then,
it's quite nice talking to you. I feel like it's all coming full circle.
Yeah. Exactly. And was Otis back then? Was that before they moved to Westchester, or were they in like MacArthur Park still?
Yep.
Got it.
That's right. We were in MacArthur Park.
Right. And were there any luminary teachers back then?
The people that were meaningful to me were Michael Wingo, who taught drawing, Roy Dowell, who taught some painting, and Colin Gardner, who taught critical theory.
Right.
I think Roy's probably the most well-known of the three.
Yeah. Well, I remember Colin Gardner used to write for the L.A. Times many years ago, right?
Yeah.
And I think
he used to write for our forum as well.
Oh, is that right? So where did he go after his days in Los Angeles? As far as you know,
I have to tell you the truth. I have no idea.
Okay, so he's
I think he's on the West Coast somewhere.
Oh, okay. I was just going to say, this is a case of somebody who was quite visible in the art world and has now fallen into a black hole, basically.
Yes, but I think he was writing a PhD at the time, and it was on film studies, so it's quite possible he's quite a famous person in the film studies world.
Right. Yeah. That is possible. So getting back to in our little sort of mini bio, now that you're in London, or you know, you landed in London after Oxford, and so you've been there for many years now, and you're also based in Singapore, and so I guess the thing that comes to mind among others is that there are a lot of parallels because Singapore has a British kind of flavor, as I think you've mentioned in your writing. I mean, has it been in any way a sort of logical second home to be in London?
Well, I have no idea. I feel like I've traveled by accident. Mm-hmm. They were never. I always thought I would land up in New York,
mm-hmm.
and my entire family is in Singapore, so I go, everyone's getting old, so you have to go home.
Right.
And so I spend, as they get older, I seem to spend longer and longer amounts of time there. And mm-hmm. as the art world in Singapore has actually appeared only in the last 5 or 6 years.
Right.
And I guess in a way, to me, London, England is a nice place to be because I feel like they get my sense of humor here,
mm-hmm,
whereas
mm-hmm.
I always thought in America no one gets my sense of humor.
Too dry.
although I keep thinking, well, America can't be so bad. They have The Simpsons. That's pretty remarkable.
Right.
I think if you're a young artist, you always have to go to a big art world, and so it was the biggest art world I knew to go to at the time. I mean, when I finished at Oxford, I tried to go to New York, and I couldn't figure out how to get there. And what I did realize was to work in an art world, you have to go somewhere where you know some people to get in if you're going to just appear one day.
Yeah.
And London was the art world where I knew the most people.
Right. That was smart. That was really smart.
I mean, It took a long time. I mean, a very good friend of mine many years ago moved to Berlin, and I said to him, I think it takes you 10 years to enter an art world if you're just going to start from scratch,
mm-hmm.
as in if you don't go to art school or you know, someone doesn't give you a job straight away.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I think 10 years is at the minimum. It seems.
Yes, I know. I have these conversations with people who are trying to enter an art world, and I just say, look, go to graduate school. It's not cheap, but it's the quickest way to do it. Nobody believes me.
Yeah. Well, I was just talking to an artist the other day and here in Los Angeles who, like me, didn't go to grad school here, you know, and so, mm-hmm. you know, there's always sort of this mutual identification, appreciation, you know, that you didn't sort of enter into that, you know, safety zone.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, doing an MFA is a business degree. I mean, it helps you. There are, you know, it helps you with certain skills and mm-hmm. development. Mm-hmm. But essentially, it's about acquiring a peer group, understanding what happens outside of the studio.
Right.
Did you ever think about getting an MFA in London? That's what it looks like.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I was just going to say, did you ever think about getting an MFA in London?
No, I'm one of those very stubborn, very thick-headed people that I always think I know what I'm doing. Bit of a mistake, but
right.
still.
Yeah. Well, you figured it out.
Yeah. I'm still working on it. I mean, the career's appearing after 30 years, but you know.
Right. And your name is anglicized. What's the situation with that?
Yes. Well, my full name is Sherman Sam Mentat. So when I was growing up in Singapore, everyone had a Christian name or a Western name.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents just gave me one. It's in my passport.
Mm-hmm.
And I just use it. Actually, I use it because that's what my parents called me. I sometimes wish I use my Chinese name as my writing name, so I could have two identities. But
right.
I think it's all a bit late now.
Right. Well, so virtually everybody that you grew up with were given Christian names. Does that have something to do
yes.
with some kind of colonialist thing?
I'm not sure. I wonder whether it has to do with fashion as well. People thought it was cool to have a Western name.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you go around Southeast Asia, a lot of people still have Western names.
Right.
For whatever reason, my parents wanted SS as my initial, so I got Sherman.
That's interesting that they wanted SS. Let's not get into that.
Second World War history reads differently.
Right, exactly. Well, I'm really interested. I've been kind of building up to talking specifically about Singapore, but I think listeners, you know, have a lot of real shortage, I would imagine, like I do, of of Singapore history and context. But
sure.
To give people to throw out a couple of cliches or you know the most sort of sensational pieces of information about Singapore. One of them is that you're not allowed to chew gum, and you know it's punishable by jail time. You know if you're caught placing gum somewhere or something to that effect. Am I correct?
that's not entirely true.
Okay,
it is the nice. I wish they would make it legal because I just keep saying to people, you know, I have to answer these questions. People
right.
ask me.
Right.
It's not illegal to chew gum. It's not illegal to have gum. It is, however, illegal to sell gum.
Uh-huh.
So there is you can't chew it because there ain't much of it around.
Right.
Now, if you were to fly to Singapore and you had a suitcase full of gum,
mm-hmm.
and you could somehow demonstrate that that's all the gum you need to chew, no one would stop you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
If they didn't believe you, they might confiscate it, but they wouldn't arrest you.
Right. But and if you're caught throwing gum away on the street, that's punishable by something pretty severe, right?
Well, it's a fine. It's a heavy fine.
Mm-hmm,
but,
mm-hmm.
Like $50.
Oh, okay.
But I've never heard... I have met one person who's had a fine for littering.
Mm-hmm.
And Singapore is, to be fair, a reasonably clean place. Now, I have to say, all this, in a way, all this kind of neuroticism grows out of the fact that it is 2 degrees off the equator. So it's hot. It's very hot. It's very sticky. And germs grow very quickly. Food
right.
goes off. If you leave food on the table, there'll be ants, flies, and probably it'll go off in a few hours. So it would be unwise to eat it. And I suspect cleanliness has to do with that.
Yeah. It doesn't actually, you know what, the more that we're talking about it, the more appealing it is to me. I mean, especially I would think for a number of New York city people listening to this,
yeah.
they're thinking, yeah, that sounds good to me. I mean, I step in wet, fresh gum every day, you know.
That's the one thing I tell people, you know, it's all those black spots on the pavement.
Yeah.
You hardly ever see it in Singapore.
Right, yeah, that's nice.
But what I tell people is I don't object to Singapore. I mean, it's a very clean, organized country. And I always say, if you have a kind of an accountant, banker type mentality, or you're a stick in the mud, it's a perfect place to go because it's a country built for you. I think if you're a kind of creative, you know, shoot from the hip type of person, you might feel it's a bit restricting.
Right. Yeah.
It's also a very, very small country. I mean, there's very, very, you know, you can, its charms can wear thin very quickly.
Yeah. And you mentioned actually in your piece about the Singapore art scene in, was it Art Critical?
Yes.
That it, you use the analogy, the size of the Isle of Man, which is, you know, a pretty modest sized island. But I think maybe could we use another more relatable reference point? Like, is it as big as, say, a certain city in the U.S. or Europe as far as size?
I'm very, very. We're going to have to look it up on Google.
Okay.
To figure that out.
Yeah.
Because I have no sense of scale. But let me say in a very simple way.
Sure.
If you drive from, if you drive from east to west, which is the longer part of the island,
mm-hmm.
You speed, you can probably get from one end to the other end in about 30 to 45 minutes if there's not much traffic.
Okay, got it.
How far is that in LA?
That's a good question. Because if you can actually, if there's no traffic and you're speeding, you can go from the west side to downtown in about 20 minutes, 15 to 20 minutes actually. So that's actually a pretty long stretch of land. But is it narrow as well?
It's not narrow. It's longer east to west than it is north to south.
Right.
And it's growing. They're reclaiming land. So I think it's one of the fastest growing countries in the world.
Wow.
Percentage wise.
Mm-hmm.
But they're buying sand. There's running jokes that different Southeast Asian countries don't want to sell us their sand anymore because we're putting it into the ground.
the other big, or one of the other sort of maybe lesser known cliches or tidbits about Singapore is the severity of its anti-drug laws. Is that right? I mean, because I know in Malaysia,
yes.
which is a neighboring country, that because I actually.
Yes.
Passed through Malaysia years ago, and they said on the plane there was some kind of, you know, auto message on the plane that, you know, if you're caught with drugs, you know, you'll get the death penalty or something to that effect. So is it similar?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's exactly the same. I think it's the same in Indonesia as well. The punishment for drug dealing is death, and
right.
The amount they have to catch you with is a very, very small amount.
Wow.
So if you happen to not be a drug dealer and just happen to have a very big, severe addiction and you're carrying your stuff with you, it's not a good idea.
Right. Okay. Be forewarned, listeners.
Yeah. That's true. But what I always say to people is the flip side of that is it's very effective. There's very little obvious drug use.
Right.
This also has very, very harsh laws on crime. So crime is quite low.
Right.
It's also very low because, you know, it's a small island. Everybody knows everyone's shit. It's very hard to get away with.
How many people, though, are in Singapore, roughly?
I think it's 5 million.
Mm-hmm. So when you say everyone knows everyone, but maybe you're talking about very specific neighborhoods or particular cultures or something along those lines?
Yeah, a bit of both. But it is very, you know that film 5 degrees of separation? I think
six degrees, right.
Two.
I see. Everybody's two in Singapore. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, got it. Right.
Someone knows someone. You know?
Right, I see. Yeah.
In some ways, it's nice. It's a very safe country. It's very orderly. It's very organized. The government is very concerned with productivity. You know, making sure people do well.
Mm-hmm.
But I always say it's a trade-off. So you have to vote the government in because they'll keep trying to do well. But you have to put up with whatever laws they want to create.
Right. But when you're there, you know, over the last, say, decade, how much of the time are you spending outside of sort of family activity? I mean, you've obviously written about art there. Is that something you do every time you go back?
I try to.
Mm-hmm.
How do I say this? When I was going back before, there was very little art world, so I would try and treat it as time to rest. When I travel, I draw when I travel.
Mm-hmm.
So you would spend the time just being at home drawing and vegging out in front of the TV.
Right.
But in the last, let's say, decade, there's been more art world. And so there's been more people to see, things to look at. Not necessarily a lot of things I like.
Right.
I don't always like it. I always tell people, you know, it's very important to rest. And as I get older, I think even more so, you know, you need to go somewhere where you don't walk into a museum, you're not going into a gallery, you're not running into people that are in the industry.
Right, absolutely, yeah.
So Singapore has now become a place of work rather than a place of rest.
That's unfortunate. So next time you go, you're going to want... Most of you is going to want to rest, but there's going to be some magnetic pull to like, oh, I should really go see this thing.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, or I should know what's going on.
Right.
It's come about because in Singapore they've solved some of the problems. More people are educated, a lot of people, there's work, so on and so forth. So they started to think, well, culture is something that's quite important. There is cultural tourism, but it's also important to have culture. So as I said in, I think it's an Art Review article, if they succeed, it'll be one of the few countries where culture comes from the top down. I mean, I think mostly culture is sort of very, a very organic thing. People make art, people decide they like to show art, they start businesses to show art. Very big collectors decide to give work to museums. I mean, this museum culture thing is a relatively recent, you know, it's a 20th century thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Having museums in cities. So the government's decided they need all this. So they put infrastructure in place. They created a kind of an art park, it's Bergamont Station.
Yeah.
Sort of a gallery district,
right,
where people could go and see commercial galleries. They create a contemporary art museum.
Right. To what extent would you categorize the art being made by local Singaporean artists as in any way reflecting that sort of, you know, as you said, or categorized culture of Singapore in a certain way as a place that makes stick in the muds happy? do you find that the art sort of engages in that sort of sensibility, either rejecting it, you know, wholly, or in some way reflecting it, or is it total non-issue?
Well, I think a lot of Southeast Asian art, and I only say this for spending time in Singapore and going to the Singapore Biennial, so mm-hmm. I think there's the idea of Southeast Asian art is actually much more varied than I'm about to describe.
Mm.
Is very sort of identity politics inspired. I'm sure you do. You know what I mean by this? Involved.
Yeah. Is that the same identity politics that started to become very popular in the late '80s, early '90s?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I blame it all on that Whitney Biennial.
Right.
That's one of them, right?
Right.
93, I believe.
Right, right, right. So somehow that particular sensibility, that political moment is what's bloomed in the Southeast Asian art politics.
Yes, but I think there's several ways to look at this. It's a lot of the young artists went to Goldsmiths in London, or they went to the Glasgow School of Art. I think there's a contingent of them. And that's where what you are saying is correct. It's part of the colony, so they've come here to go to art school.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two places where a lot of that type of art has been made since the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It to me, it's a kind of problem-solving art. my bugbear as a person who makes art and looks at art is I always say what annoys me is what I call morally good art. Let's say an artwork's content says, I'll make a stupid idea like be nice to other people, be nice to women, or treat people of color the same as you. It's its content. And people look at the art, they look at, they read the content and go, oh, this art is good because its moral content is good.
Right.
And that's, to me, that's, its moral content could be good, but it, as an object of art, it could be completely crap, but they're not seeing the two different things.
Right.
And I think in a lot of Southeast Asian art, there's a lot of this kind of art.
I see. Interesting.
And so they're trying to, a lot of, I suspect there are a lot of bureaucrats involved, and it's the type of art that's easy to support and promote because they can say, this art says this, or this art does that.
Right.
And you know, whereas if you make sort of ambiguous visual objects, it's much more difficult to say, this is a good work of art.
Right. As somebody who, even though you're based in London, is Singaporean, that's the right adjective, right? Singaporean, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Good.
Correct.
Good. I just want to make sure.
Well done.
Thank you. I wanted to know if, even though you're London based, as a you know, Singaporean born and bred, are you eligible for the biennials and that kind of thing?
I am, but they haven't discovered me yet. I keep advertising myself to them, but I don't know what it's going to take.
Right. Well, that actually dovetails with a number of things that I think would be interesting to look at. And one of the ones that I wanted to get to was that you are bridging the East and West to a certain extent. And I wonder if that's something that the publications that you write for are, you know, are interested in you for, and I wonder if you are seen that way, and I wonder if that's expected of you, you know, that you contain this this dual eye representing both hemispheres.
I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, I'm still baffled that people let me write and print me. I certainly, they like the fact that I travel and I can contribute from different places. Because as you know, if you don't, there aren't many English language writers in certain parts of the world. So
right.
That know a lot about art. So it's useful that way. But certainly for when I write for Art Review, I think that that's a nice thing for them because I think Art Review is very interested in Asia. In Art Forum's case, it's really about the contributors are place located. So London was a place. I happened to be lucky in that when I was offered it, they were losing writers in London. You know, and the reason I wrote for them is I'm friends with my editor, and I think he was about to leave town, so he said, you know, do you want to take a slot?
Right.
Which is nice.
Yeah.
You know, I still think I'm lucky.
Well, since we're on the subject, because it's definitely something it's definitely something I wanted to get to, is that you write for Art Forum. From what I gathered, you know, I read a few of your pieces, your contributor pieces, and your, I guess, is that one of your titles, contributor to Art Forum? Contributing writer?
Yeah.
So the category of writing you do for them, from what I gather, is of the review sort of type, right? So if you were to break down the editorial content of Art Forum, you have the reviews, the top tens, whatever, you know, the lists, that kind of thing, the recommendations, you know, those sort of pieces, which if people who read Art Forum, I would guess they're more likely to read those. And then you have the features, you know, the really dense, long pieces.
Yes. Well, how almost all art magazines work is, there's I describe it as front, middle, and back.
Okay.
So the front bit is a kind of preview editorial section.
Mm-hmm.
The middle is the features, mm-hmm. and the back is the reviews.
Right.
So I think, actually, I think I'll never graduate from being, I'll probably never graduate from the back. And the back is, the back really is the news. It's like you go out, you see the stuff,
mm-hmm.
you write what you witness. It's
right.
It's in one way, it's the front line. The middle bit, anyone can contribute to the middle bit. You write to the editor, you say, I'd like to write about this. If it happens to be something they think is important and that needs covering, and you are the right person to cover it, they'll commission you to cover it.
But
obviously, it's a lot more complicated than that.
Well, I was going to say, of course it is, but the one easy distinction, though, I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong about the middle or the feature writers, is that they've got to be almost all academics of some degree.
It varies a lot. I mean, there are some people who are just career art writers.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't consider them academics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would say that art writing doesn't pay very well.
Mm-hmm.
So you need another job of many jobs. And it's something you have to be interested in doing. I remember when I was writing my art history degree, one of my tutors is a very eminent art critic, Stuart Morgan. He gave a talk and we were all there listening to it. And a very young Japanese girl came up and to him after and said, "Oh, Mr. Morgan, I love your writing. I want to, when I grow up or when I start working, I want to be just like you." And he had a completely horrified look on his face and said, "Please don't do that. You're not going to make any money."
Right. That's funny.
And Stuart's famous, you know.
Wow. Well, when you said, I need to go back to when you said you don't think you'll ever graduate from the back. I wonder, first of all, if you want to graduate. And let me just add one other thing, and that
yes.
is that trailing my comment about the type of people that write the features, which I feel are really heavily academic people. I think
yes.
the features are the least read articles in the magazine.
To tell you the truth, I have no idea. As a writer, when I write a review, I always assume only a handful of people read it.
Uh-huh.
The artists, their parents, their dealers,
mm-hmm.
and the next person who's going to write a review about their work. I'm always
right.
pleasantly and happily surprised when someone says to me, "Oh, I read your piece. It was interesting. Blah blah blah." And I'm like, "Really? You read it?"
Right.
When I was a student, I used to love reading art magazine. I was just fascinated. It was my education into art.
Mm-hmm.
I just read it as many as I could from the library. And the moment I started writing, I stopped reading. I found it was no longer a pleasure to read an art magazine. I just looked at it and I thought, this is work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I tend to read the features. I tend to look at the photos and I think, oh, that's an artwork that looks interesting. Then I'll read that. Or because I'm a painter,
mm-hmm.
an abstract painter, if there's an article about painting or an article about abstraction,
right.
I'll read those. I do think a lot of people who become art writers don't start off being writers. They start off being something. Maybe they're artists, maybe they're curators. They don't. A lot of art magazine writing sometimes is very boring, very hard to read.
Yes, particularly features in Art Forum.
Yes. Well,
let's not mince words here.
They put the Art Forum in later. It's not my fault.
No, I wasn't referring to your articles. I was referring to the features, the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. there are some, well, academics aren't natural writers.
Yeah.
You know, they don't learn to write. They learn to express ideas, sometimes
right.
not very healthily.
Well said. Well said.
I always tell people, you want to test how good a writer you are. Take a piece of writing you write, get into public transport and try and read it. If you can read it, you've done well.
Right. That's a great exercise. What about the conceit, Sherman, that I've heard and I agree with about a lot of art forum feature type articles or you know, critical articles and other critical journals, where the writer has a subject, right? It might be a single individual artist, or it might be a movement or something. And what happens is that they take that artist or that movement as a starting point, and then the article becomes an exercise in writing, in philosophy, in critical discourse that may or may not have something to do with that subject at the end of the piece.
That always, someone said to me, I sometimes think philosophers have the most interesting ideas about philosophy, but they have the worst taste in art. they're looking for the artwork that illustrates, and I use the word illustrates,
right.
philosophy.
Right.
Rather than embody the philosophy.
Right.
And I think so they're writing an idea, and sometimes it's better to read the philosophical bit and just then use it to think about art. And I think philosophy and theory, any kind of stuff like literary stuff, it's all useful for thinking about art. But it's not useful necessarily for making art, because the art then just becomes an illustration of theory.
Right.
Or whatever, you know. And there's very little of that kind of art that's really that good. The artist has to actually be a very, very good artist.
Yeah.
But I just think we're also in a time where there are a lot of artists, and we're in a real hurry to be all successful artists. And the market, when it supports it, doesn't necessarily support very good art.
Mm.
Sorry, we're drifting off a little bit from your question.
No, that's okay.
I think it's good to... It depends on what you're reading and what you're writing. I did write an article recently, and it was about ceramics. And it wound up being, this artist does this, this artist does that, this artist does this, and this artist does that. And it all had to do with, these were all people who are having shows.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't an overarching theory or argument. It just was like a little news roundup. I didn't particularly like that piece of writing, because I really hate reading. You read an article and it doesn't have a huge point except to say, for example, in this case, well, ceramics is rather fashionable right now. So there's these different extremes of how people are working with clay.
Right.
Which is the exact opposite of a very, very philosophically heavy or theoretically heavy piece of writing, which
right.
doesn't have much to say about the artworks.
Right. That's right. Yeah, actually, ceramics is, you know, without having read your piece, but it's that topic of ceramics came up in a somewhat similar conversation on the podcast not too long ago. I mean, just as sort of a reference point, you just mentioned the expression ceramics, and you think, oh, yeah, that's kind of a market trend.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's what happens. We work in an industry, and there are fashions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just about if the skirt is shorter, or the pleats are, there are pleats this season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's great, because I know a lot of 70-year-old ceramicists who are suddenly in fashion.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, imagine waiting 60 years.
Right.
A friend of mine whose entire career has been, he's a sculptor who works in clay, but in a more sort of technical way. So his entire complaint is like, oh, now if you're 30 years old, you know, you don't have to be very good. Everyone's giving you shows.
Right.
But it happens.
Yeah. One question that's really rising fast in the midst of all this is when you're doing the writing, and by the way, I want to just mention for listeners that you've been writing for, if not past tense, written for Brooklyn Rail, Art Critical, Art Review, Art Forum, and this, I guess, newer and more Eastern-based site called Ocula, right?
Yes, Ocula is an online website.
Okay, got it. Based in Hong Kong.
Based in Hong Kong and Australia.
Oh, and Australia. Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
So doing all the writing that you're doing, or the you know, whether it's the reviews or the coverage, you know, so to speak, and being an artist, you know, which is something that's an interesting hybrid that a lot of people engage in one form or another. But one of the big questions that makes me wonder about is, you know, how good you are at sort of separating the two things, you know. Here, okay, I'm going into my writer mode and I'm going to just be the writer covering these things or writing these reviews. And now I'm going into the artist mode, as opposed to, you know, at a certain point, writing reviews of all these people going, you know, I'm getting a little burnt out on this. I kind of want somebody to write about me.
Yes. Was that a yes or no answer?
Yes. You can say yes, sure.
I think I never planned. I never planned to be an art writer.
Mm-hmm.
It really was something that accidentally happened. But very few people plan to be critics. You know, it's not. It's just someone says, "Oh, would you write about this?" And then the next thing you know, it's 10 years later, and you're writing for 3 magazines.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I always say to people, the thing about art is. The thing about writing about art, the thing about curating art, is it needs many, many voices, many, many eyes. It's not. There are people who only write. There are people who are academics. There are people who are art historians. There are people who are curators. There are people who are, for lack of a better word, fans. They should all write because. You bring a different voice, you bring a different point of view to what it is we see. And I think it's important that it is diverse. And diversity has to be with thinking and seeing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we have a kind of a monoculture. I mean, human beings naturally want to be homogenous. We want to be the same. We don't want to be different.
Mm-hmm.
Even when we are different, I mean, America is the great country where everyone is different. That's why you're the same. and it's important to write. First of all, but secondly, as I was saying earlier, when you land in an art world, nobody wants to talk to you if you're an artist. There are way too many artists.
Yeah.
It's also a way to meet people, to network into the system.
Mm.
And people want to talk to you if you write.
Yeah.
It is nice to be written about. I mean, the nice thing about Art Forum is I have been reviewed in Art Forum before I ever started writing for them.
Mm.
So that immediately took that off the agenda.
Right. So going back to your earlier comment about, you know, you're always surprised when people say they saw your Art Forum review. What about when you got the Art Forum review? Was it more than just your parents and your gallerist who said they saw your review?
To tell you the truth, I have no idea. It's out there in the world. I hope someone reads it. I'll send it to you later. You can read it.
Okay, I will. Good. When was it from?
It was from a show in a gallery in Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
Nearly 10 years ago now.
Okay.
So I think it was 2007.
Did it make your dealer happy, having that review in Art Forum?
Yeah, she rang me up. She says, critics keep coming. I was also reviewed in Art Review. And that was, I think, also before I started writing for them.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, critics keep coming in. Tell them to stop coming. But sometimes I think I always make this joke. I always say, you know, if I could go to a gallery and say, I'll review this show, you give me a show. If that worked, I think I would try and use it every single time.
Sure. Right. Yeah.
But it doesn't work like that because
no.
they're businesses. And, you know, the bottom line of a business is money.
Yeah.
Not criticism. So, you know, there is another equation at work.
Right. But there is more value placed on an art forum review than probably any other review, with the exception of the New York Times.
Yes, I guess. But I always say this to people, I have yet to write a review where a dealer has rung me up saying, hey, thanks for that review, I sold out the whole show.
Right.
A friend of mine, I only know one art dealer, who said someone walked into his gallery, bought an artwork because they bought a copy of Time Out and they saw a review in it and they said, oh, I like this art, went to the gallery and bought the work.
Mm-hmm.
But a friend of mine who works in a gallery said, actually, if you show someone and you have many, many reviews, you probably will sell work.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced. Because the gallery he works for is kind of a blue chip gallery, they're gonna sell work anyway.
Right. He's not exactly giving you the best study.
Yeah, I mean it's meaningful. I take it seriously. I think the thing that's very consuming about art writing, and coming back to being a painter, is that it takes you a lot of time to see the shows.
Yeah.
You know you have to go out. Every week you have to look at art, and there are galleries that are far away. So, you know, you could go to a gallery and that's your whole day gone.
Mm.
And that takes up a lot of time. And the other thing is, the longer you work in the art world and the more people that know you, the more things you get invited to go to socially.
Yeah.
So you wind up going to these things to find out what's going on, to meet people and so on and so forth. And that takes time. And the art I make is very... It's not physically laborious. It's time-consuming in that it takes. I need to look at it a lot and think about it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So, I feel like the last 2 or 3 years, the writing has taken up some of the time, my working time.
Yeah. Yeah, that example that you mentioned of going, you know, way across town to see that show that's going to eat up a lot of your day. That's a really important example because I don't think I've done that per se, but I certainly, if I'm going to see a show way across town, you know, I feel like there better be a really good reason for it, you know, especially if it's a destination gallery where there aren't, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 others nearby.
Yeah.
So when you think of that example, did you do it because you knew it was going to be an important show, or were you taking a chance?
I'm taking a chance.
Mm-hmm.
I never believe what I see on the internet or what I read. So I think you have to go and see the object.
Right.
So very often it looks good online or it looks like shit online. You know, 9 times out of 10, what you see online is not the reality of what you get.
Yeah.
And it's, you try to be wise about it. As you do it more, you try and be smarter about it. But, you know, you always wind up going somewhere and you think, oh, that was a waste of my... This is going to be a waste of my day.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
But it's work. And the thing is, it's unpaid work.
Yeah.
It's stuff you're just doing because this is what we do in our job.
Right. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry. I think as an artist, you do that as well. You go and you see things.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think as an artist, you have a lot more. Artists who are not writing. I'm going to use the second person. Can be very. Limited, or they can be very selective, I should say, about, you know, what they decide to go and see, and they can miss things, and it's not the end of the world. I did, for by the way, just to mention something slightly relevant, I saw an Instagram post that somebody put up of a show that they weren't going to get to. They really missed it. And somebody in one of the comments below said, best show of the summer or something like that, or of the year, you know, that you missed, you know. So I don't know why I bring that up other than I just thought of it. But I guess there's sort of a critical mass around certain shows, you know, where people say, oh, yeah, you got to go see that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But most of the shows are not that. So you're kind of on your own, you know, and you're making a calculation based on if you know anything about what you know about the gallery, what you know about the artist, if anything, and so on.
Yes, but the other thing is it's very idiosyncratic. I mean, I think the difference when you're an artist, you're looking in a different way from when you're a critic. The thing I like about being a critic is it offsets being an artist. You have to have a kind of different mindset. You know, when you're an artist, there is a kind of right and wrong, you know. I'm right, everyone else is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're a critic, it's more like you're trying to see what the artist is right about.
Right.
You can disagree with it.
Right.
In fact, a lot of times you're disagreeing with it, but you're trying to see it, you know. And every critic, everyone that's looking at art has to come from a different point of view. Some people are more interested in these things rather than those things.
Mm-hmm.
I think the criticism has allowed me to be interested in other kinds of art that I find interesting but wouldn't be interested in if I was an artist.
Right.
And also, I said this to Michelle, or Michelle's students,
mm-hmm.
Grabner,
mm-hmm.
and I said, you know, it's kind of social work what I do. I feel like I contribute to my community when I write, when I curate, and it's the only community I really care about, the people who work in art, because this is my community. So if I can support something I think is good, that is better than someone else not supporting this artist or curating the show with these people in it.
Mm-hmm.
Just like what I think you do is a contribution to the world, the art world we all work in.
Mm-hmm. Would you say it's about an even mix of the shows that you wind up writing about between ones that you see and choose to write about as compared with ones that you are predetermined to write about? What's that division like?
Actually, there isn't that. What we do in most, I think, what most critics do is they pitch to their magazines. So mm-hmm. they say, "I've seen these three shows.
Right.
Would you like any of these reviewed?" And then they'll come back to you and say yes or no, or we prefer this. We like the first choice or the third choice or the
right.
fifth choice.
Right.
Once a year, the magazines I write for will say, "Hey, have you seen this show? Did you like it?
Mm-hmm.
Shall we cover it?"
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I say yes, and other times I say, "You kidding me?"
So, in other words, when you're going, whether it's to a show that's, I don't know, you know, 5-10 minutes away from where you live, or that one way, way over on the other end of town where it's like I might be killing a day here, you're seeing all of those shows, both, you know, as an artist sort of loading up your consciousness, and as a critic to potentially write about.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I mean, it also gets you out there. I think when you're just an artist, you can actually say, "I don't want to know what's going on." And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are actually very few rules to being an artist.
Right.
You can sit in your studio all you want. You can just go to a cafe, sit down, make art on your notebook, ring your fabricator, have it manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
You can make artwork out of hotel rooms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think it's sometimes nice to see what other people are doing.
Sure.
It's your community.
Right. Do you feel connected to your community in London? To what extent do you, I should say?
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
The community I like is the New York art world.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't live in it, but I like it. I think it's a very small, the place where all the art gets shown is in a very small landmass. So all the artists can go around.
Right.
Efficiently. So everyone knows what everyone is doing, more or less, and they're quite gregarious about it.
Mm-hmm.
In London, they're kind of little groupings. So sometimes you can go to one opening and you'll see a whole bunch of people that you never see in any other opening.
Mm.
And it's because in London, as a friend of mine was saying, you know, in New York, you can probably do 20 openings in one night.
Right.
But in London, if you have three openings in three different bits of town, sort of like LA,
yeah,
it's very difficult to do all three. You might be able to do two, and then suddenly think, well, I'm just going to sit down and have a drink now, and that's the end of your evening.
Yeah. I had, you reminded me of one very specific night. It was about a year and a half ago, I would guess, where I went to three openings in three slightly different parts of town. And it was they were all guys, and they all were alumni of the podcast. So, you know, and I was, I was friendly with them in varying degrees, but I was like, I have to go to all these shows. And, you know, it worked out fine, basically, but it's definitely not something I want to do every week, once a year at most, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's when Frieze happens in London, which is the big art fair.
Sure.
Everyone's having an opening, and you know, you see people running around like headless chickens. Everyone's going somewhere. Everyone's late for something.
Right.
And it's kind of nice. It's what New York is like every month.
Right. Yeah. How often do you go to New York, by the way?
I try to go there twice a year. But now I'm trying to go to Singapore twice a year, so maybe I'm thinking of going to New York once a year.
Sure.
I love it. I really like the New York. I you can see so much there.
Yeah.
Very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And what I like about New York artists is they care. They're interested. You know, they go out, they see these things, then they argue about it.
Right.
So if a show gets a review in the New York Times, every artist I run into says, have you seen so-and-so's show?
Mm-hmm. Right. What do you think, though, about, and this is something that I've talked about occasionally, I especially talk about this in relation to art fairs, and that is, you know, too much art. You know, I mean, when I see art, I don't go to art fairs, and when I do see shows in LA, like if I dedicate part of an afternoon to seeing shows, it's usually capped at probably around, you know, 7-8 galleries. That's pretty much the most I see these days. You know, I could certainly do more if I wanted to or needed to, but when you're going to Chelsea or now the Lower East Side, you know, and you could see 50, 70 galleries, right, in one day, like with an art fair, you know, and you being somebody who's a professional looker, you know, at what point, you know, how strong of a filter do you have to be able to sort of not have everything blend together?
I don't know. It depends on the day. I try and see as much as I can. I like doing it in New York because you can see a lot of painting in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're in London, there's a lot less painting. I'm not a big fan of art fairs either, or
mm-hmm.
biennials for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
I frequently say to people, you really want to find out what's going on. If you're really interested in art, you just go around the art world every month. Go to the galleries. You follow a gallery's program for a whole year.
Mm-hmm.
That's much more interesting because you see exhibitions of artists making, let's call it a statement, making a show. Whereas when you're going to a biennial or you're going to an art fair, it's kind of slight. It's someone else's point of view. In the art fair, in the case of an art fair, it's anarchy.
Yeah.
And I almost think I have more chance of seeing more interesting things by going to an art fair than going to a biennial. I distrust curators.
Wow.
I think they have an agenda. And mm-hmm. so what you see is their agenda. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you go to an art fair, there's no agenda except the market, what these people think they're going to be able to sell this year. So, you know, because it's so anarchistic, there is a chance you might find an interesting artist, and then which will lead you to maybe going to their gallery or going to their shows.
Right. But you trust an art fair as far as viewing the art more than you do biennial, because it's more of a anarchistic, open-ended kind of thing, whereas with a biennial, it's very specific. Like, what about Venice? Have you been to Venice? Let's take that as an example.
Yes. I think Venice is... let me think. I'm just trying to think. I think I've been to Venice 8 or 9 times, and I think I've seen 3 I liked.
Okay.
Venice is probably, I want to say, the best. I don't know if it's the best. I think it certainly has the most chance of being interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I just very seldom... You know, biennials always seem to make very big... they show big statement art. And
right.
I'm not sure I'm interested in big statement anymore.
Ah, okay. Got it. Right. Why do you think that is?
They don't look like... It just seems like a... It's a kind of like multiplex mentality.
Mm.
I hope I don't ever get quoted by that.
So are you making an analogy to like a small independent theater versus, you know, a big ugly
yes.
multiplex that shows films in 3D and that kind of thing?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think we get a lot. But I think our world today is more Instagram. It's more spectacular. It's more Facebook.
Right.
And I think that's the kind of art. That kind of biennial, the biennial reflects that kind of our social situation.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't like the state of the world, in other words, like most of us, is what you're saying.
Do you?
No. No, but
we've,
I mean...
We live troublesome times.
Yeah, indeed. But I mean, they always have been, haven't they?
Yes. I mean, you and I are lucky. In a way, we do what we want. We're doing the thing we want to do.
More or less.
More or less. We yeah. don't necessarily get as much money as for
right.
what we do
right.
as we would like to.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that's how the cookie crumbles.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, there are so many nuances within that, and I don't want to get bogged down in them, but just to use one, since
yeah.
you said it was a... You went from the multiplex to social media, you know, and you mentioned Instagram and Facebook. I feel that way about
yeah.
Facebook. I feel like Facebook is the embodiment of that sort of multiplex or spectacular kind of mentality. But I started using Instagram just within the last 12 months, and I'm actually much happier there. And I think it can be a really good, while yes, I mean, it's frustrating that the people who have the most followers have, you know, a spectacular style of, you know, of images.
Yes.
But there's still aspects of it that are more grassrootsy, you know?
Yeah. I'm going to look at your Instagram after we finish.
Okay, that sounds great. Fantastic. But getting back to actually the bigger question or point here, which is that you don't like biennials for the most part because they're a sort of based in a spectacular or, you know, spectacularity in
yes.
their art. You wrote one of the pieces that you wrote that I read was about Richard Tuttle. And I wonder if this might be a little sort of a sensational way of putting it, but I wonder if you appreciate more of a Richard Tuttle world of art. And that would sort of be your ideal world of art as compared to that other end of the spectrum.
Yes, I would agree with you. I think that is true. And I don't want an art world that's all like that. But
right.
I would like that type of art to be appreciated.
Right.
More. I was talking to someone about a museum in Singapore, and I said to this person, but look, you know, Richard Tupper would never get a show there. I mean, what's wrong?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a great artist, but because it's not obviously literary, you couldn't explain the greatness of his work with words. You couldn't even say this is socially driven art.
Mm-hmm.
It somehow makes it seem, for lack of a better word, just formalist. And formalist is not the right word either. I say to people, you know, I think if I was using words to describe my work, one of the words I would use is intuitive. And there's very little space in the world, in our art world, where you can somehow talk about intuitively made art.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that there isn't a lot of it being made. It's mm-hmm. just that not a lot of it is talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Because we live in a time where everyone is asked to explain what they do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I met an artist recently that said he just heard a talk given by David Sally, and he said David Sally had said if he had any complaint about our time, he said too much emphasis is put on the artist's intent.
Mm.
And I it's something
I agree
like
with that.
That, I think.
Who was that, Sherman, that you mentioned?
Who was David Sally?
Oh, David Sally. Got it. Right.
Yeah, who had said that?
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting artist to talk about intent, but we don't want to go down that road.
that's a very long conversation.
A very long one indeed. Well, first of all, I mean, I did want to mention that in one of the earlier things you said, Richard Tuttle did have a Whitney retrospective, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, so it's not like he's, you know, he hasn't been lauded quite a bit.
No, but he's certainly not someone that features heavily in biennials.
Sure, that's true. That is absolutely true.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot that we could get into as far as, you know, I'm really interested that you distinguish between formalism or formalist decisions and intuitive decisions. But before we maybe get into that specifically, I want to point out that to whatever degree intention in art is either an issue or not really on the table. I think it generally is because, I mean, certainly you hear all the time, and you, I'm sure, are as well aware of anybody as of how artists' sort of shticks, you know, have become so important.
Yes.
But one of the things that I've talked about on this show quite a bit is the explosion of abstraction. And there are a lot of different subtexts to that sort of heading. One of them is that there's a lot of object making going on. So I would say if I were to give you a sort of a counterpoint or a counter argument to your issues with or distaste for the spectacularity of biennial art, I would say that one of them is with object art, you know, which has dominated art fairs, you know, quite a bit for a while. It's kind of all about catering to the collector, you know. That's kind of what it comes down to. And so the nice thing about biennial art is that it's, in a lot of cases, counter to collecting.
Well, I said to a friend of mine, a good friend of mine who's a curator, I said, you know, I need to get into the Singapore Biennial because I think that's a good way for me to get a good New York gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you can get into a biennial, biennial artists have dealers.
Right.
I mean, it's not, you know, regular biennial artists have even bigger dealers.
Sure.
I know what you're saying, but it's also a bit untrue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not a, is not a black and white thing.
No, no, of course not.
It's a much grayer thing. I think it's interesting what you say about object making. I think that's true. I think there's a lot of object making around.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the abstraction thing,
mm-hmm.
I think that's much more of an American thing than it is in a European thing.
Interesting. Explain, please.
And also, as far as the painting thing goes, I certainly think there's more painting in New York and America than there is, in a way, in London or Berlin, for that matter. But I do think every place has a specific, has its own type of regional type of art making.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think London, New York, maybe LA, they're much more international places.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly London and New York. I have to confess, it's been, I think, 20 years since I've been in LA. So
right.
I really don't. I think, and I do think places change.
Right. Yeah.
But it's nice to hear that there are places where abstraction is flourishing.
Where do you feel like, so in other words, you feel like in Berlin, you mentioned, and even in London, those are both places where it's pretty rare, and being that you're an abstract painter yourself, that's something that you want to be able to see a reasonable amount
yes.
of. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, right. And I'd like to see interesting abstractionists.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's better. I mean, the London art world in the last 10 years has grown really big. I mean, I'm guessing we're like the second biggest art world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there are big galleries, but I oftentimes think when I see abstraction here, they are by foreigners. You know, I see very local. I don't see very interesting local abstractionists.
Right.
Now, I think maybe they exist, but they just don't get shown a lot,
mm-hmm.
the interesting ones.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The thing is, as you get older, I remember when I was in art school seeing all these teachers who were sort of slightly jaded, and they've seen too much.
Right.
And I sometimes think I'm starting to get to that point. And that's where I think doing the writing's quite nice, you know. It just keeps you trying to look, to see freshly.
Mm-hmm.
I was saying to a friend, when I was in art school in my first year, one of the teachers said, okay, everybody stop. This is the most interesting thing that has happened in the class today. And he picked up a piece of paper. Two pieces of paper had fallen onto it. And it was kind of like, now in retrospect, thinking about it was kind of like a little Richard Tuttle accident.
Uh-huh.
And what he was saying is, this is all of you guys, you're just drawing these things. I see them all the time. But this
right.
is something I haven't seen.
Right.
And I sometimes think when you make art for a while, that's what you're looking for. Just
yeah.
these things that just shock you out of the world and to see things differently. And I think our art worlds aren't built that way anymore. Then people are much more interested in not trying to look at things differently.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the way that I would translate it is, I would say, it's rare that I see a show, and I imagine it applies to you as well, where you are just kind of blown away, or you're like, wow. You know,
yes.
That really
yes.
made an impression on me, and it's going to
yes.
last beyond the next 2 hours, you
yes.
know?
Yes.
So I think that's kind of another way of putting it, right?
Yes, absolutely. And
yeah.
And I think sometimes it's difficult to explain. Sometimes you go and see, you know, you go and see a show of 20 works, and maybe only one work is really great.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
all by the same person. And in the next gallery you go to, all the work's okay, but none of them is really great. And the thing you remember is actually that one work, and you always think that guy's a good artist. In fact, he only made one work that was good.
Right.
But somehow it spoke to you, or it offered you something.
Yeah. Yeah. What about abstraction, though? I mean, I think you've kind of made fairly clear, sort of inadvertently, if not overtly, you know, your sensibility, right? I guess I want to know, I mean, we could go so many different directions. I mean, just to give you and listeners a little context, sort of.
Yes.
Because of what the gallerist Charlie James said on my podcast a few years ago, he talked about how in the great arc of history, you know, all this abstraction that's getting made right now that's really hot in the marketplace would be completely irrelevant.
Yeah.
It would mean nothing to history. And so I, you know, without addressing that particular comment, what it led me to do with a lot of guests who make abstract work is I would say, what do you think about this explosion of abstraction in the marketplace? And I'm not going to necessarily ask you that question, but what I do, I think, I just wanted to use that as a context. I wanted to ask you, going back, if you remember when you first started making abstract work and at what point you sort of became self-aware that, oh, I'm an abstract painter.
It was in my final year of art school, I started making abstract work. I think in my junior year, I was starting to make abstract work. And so let's just put this in context. This is the late 80s. So in the art world, the American art world, which is the art world I was studying in, it's neo-expressionism.
Yeah.
So you have David Sally, Eric Fischel, those Italian guys, Enzo Cucchi, all that kind of, it's got sort of, Julia Schnabel, sort of semi-figurative painting. And where Otis was, you had to study all the disciplines. I mean, so painting, sculpture, drawing, performance, video, blah, 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 blah. I don't know if art schools are built that way anymore. In England, they're certainly not. And I started to make paintings. Paintings interested me because it was the hardest thing to do. And then abstraction became interesting because it was, again, a harder thing to do. It was somehow expressing without expressing, in a way. Figuration always seems to be, you know, you can point your viewer through the, let's call it a narrative, or through the images, whereas abstraction requires the viewer to try and communicate try and intuit or sense or reach to the art. And I think that's what I'm interested in. It was just, and also, I think conversely, you're interested in the kind, it's that kind of art that touches you. You are interested in making that.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm partly saying also the artwork that interests me are those kind of artworks.
Right. So if neo-expressionism was going on, was pretty dominant at that particular time when you turned to abstraction, what was feeding your direction then? What was inspiring you in that direction?
I guess it's some of my teachers, Roy, Michael.
Right.
A very big influence on me were, people I was in school with, we were looking at art magazines. They say, hey, do you know this guy's work? And a person I discovered who's now a friend is Tom Noskowski, who made very small abstract paintings. And what I liked, and so I probably should say to your listeners, I make small abstract paintings. What I liked about them were that they were very, let's call it anti-corporate. I remember everything seemed huge, big, like they were big statements. And somehow they were big statements that corporations could buy because corporations are big statement organizations. And I wanted to make something that was not a big statement, but like a conversation, so that singular people could be in dialogue with them. And that's where Tom was a very interesting artist, because actually there were very, very few artists who made work like that. The other person is an artist called Jake Bertho, who's also a New York City painter.
The guy who used to teach at Yale, right?
Yeah. He died 2 years ago.
Okay. Yeah. I remember his work.
Yeah. And they both made very small objects, and I found them very, very fascinating.
Did you see Jake Berteau's work just in reproduction, or did you see them any in person at the time?
I first saw it in reproduction, and then I made a few trips to New York and got to see some of the work.
I see, right.
And I've actually never seen a big retrospective of his work.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I could say those were very formative influences,
right,
to how I became an artist. And obviously, you know, New York artists like Gary Stefan, Jonathan Lasker, who at that point in time had a lot of press mileage.
Yeah.
You know, were people that I looked at. And I thought, well, these are people who are working in abstraction, but working in a kind of contemporary idiom.
Right.
Or like Peter Halley, you know, doing things that are possible.
Mm. I noticed that you mentioned Thomas Noskowski, and I noticed that in your writings that you wrote both about him. You also wrote about Michelle Grabner, right?
Yes.
So I wonder, I can't not ask whether, you know, writing about your friends or people you know, if to what extent that ever felt like it was off limits, or it's just like, no, I'm just writing about work that interests me.
I try and write about what interests me. I mostly write about what interests me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the case of Tom, I actually wrote about him before we became friends.
Okay.
And I'm always upfront with my editors. I say, this is my friend, or this is my friend's wife,
right,
or this is my friend's wife's dealer,
right,
who also happens to be an artist.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, if they let me write, they let me write. I think the big no-no is you're not supposed to write about your wife or your boyfriend or
right,
your dog.
I see. Got it. Okay.
But the art world is such a... corrupt is not the word, but everyone knows everyone.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult. You know, the classic line about curators is they're only curating their friends. But actually, you wind up knowing someone before you curate them. Usually, you go to their studio, so after a while,
yeah,
you know, you're friendly. There are some artists I've written about that I'm not friendly with, but I'm friendly with a lot of artists I've written about.
Right, right. And do you get to become friendly with some artists after you've written about them?
Yes, quite a few of them.
Mm-hmm,
And some people you're just not friendly with. They're busy people, or they're important people.
Right, totally. Yeah. So what's coming up
for you? As you well know.
Yeah, as I well know, as we all well know, yeah. I guess, yeah. So what's coming up for you, Sherman, as far as, I guess we're heading towards fall. I mean, is it going to be a big fall deal in London like it is in the other cities?
Yes. So as it used to be that August and September were the quiet months, and then Frieze got created. So our September is the beginning of the season. I tend to count my years from September to August. So September is when the season begins.
Mm-hmm.
The big month is October when Frieze happens.
Mm-hmm.
This year, I'm going to show for the first time in London with a young gallerist called Anka Kultis in November. And it's actually the first time I'm going to show in London properly.
Wow, that's great.
I feel a bit, after 20 years, I know, I feel a bit nervous.
Uh-huh. How do you spell the name, just so we're clear on it? Anka?
A-N-N-K-A, Anka, uh-huh. Kultis, K-U-L-T-Y-S.
Okay. And what...
go on.
What sort of district or community of galleries are they in?
It's in Hackney, so that's the East End. That's where all the young galleries used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Now all the really, really young galleries are in a place called Peckham, which is in South London.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's where I'm going to go there. It'll take me an hour to get there. Then I'm going to be lost for another 45 minutes between galleries each time.
Wow.
and then I'll finally sit down somewhere and go, why did I do this?
Right. Because this is all combination of public transport and walking, right?
Yeah. I hate driving, which is why I don't live in LA.
right.
So, when you're driving, you're not doing anything but driving. But if I'm sitting on a train, at least I can read a book.
Well, now you've got podcasts. So, next time you get a chance to be in a car, I recommend it.
Yes, fair enough. And next year, I'm going to show with a French gallery called Bernard Cesson.
Uh-huh.
That's Cesson.
Okay.
And I tell you, it's like going from feast to famine. I've never had real galleries, and now I have two galleries that want to show me. It's a bit strange.
Congratulations.
It's nice, but yeah. Strange. Thank you.
Are they in Paris?
They are in Paris, Luxembourg, Geneva, and Saint-Étienne. Bernard comes from Saint-Étienne. So he and his son started the gallery. He used to be a director at the Pompidou, and he's done a few jobs since, but after he retired, they sort of set this up. So we'll see.
Wow, that's great. And what is your artist statement going to be like? Are you going to say, are you going to quote David Sally and say attention's overrated?
No, actually, I'm going to let them worry about it. I feel that that's their job, not my job.
Good. Yeah.
The show with Anchor is actually a two-person show. It's me with another Singaporean artist. He's an artist who makes work with sound culture. And Anchor sort of suggested that she thought it might be nice to do a two-person show, and she wanted to work with sound, and I said, oh, I know a sound artist, actually, now that I know more about Song Ming's work. Mm-hmm. He's a Singaporean artist that I've admired a lot. And I thought, well, actually, this guy would be something we should do something together. And it'll be like chalk and cheese, but my thought was maybe I could write something about him and he could write something about me, and that would be the press release.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Well, Sherman, this has been great. You're really easy to talk to. I really appreciate it a lot.
No, thank you. Thank you for taking an interest.
Absolutely. And we're out.
Thank you again to Sherman. And if you are in London or Paris, go check out his shows and let me know what you think. Introduce yourself. Say you heard him on The Conversation. Always good to make the bridge, make bridges like that. And by the way, I connected briefly with somebody on Instagram who's in Korea listening to the show. So there you go. More or less Asian artist. And he was asking about Asian artists coming on the show. So I hope to have more indeed. Also heard via Facebook from a curator in Taipei. So there you go. Of course, it takes time. But did I say that this is the first international artist that we've had on the show? It's been a while, but yeah, the first full episode international artist finally getting out of the States. So yay for us. If you would like to support this show, here we go. Theconversationpod.com, best thing to do. I love, love, love seeing emails saying, and they come in a particular folder of the inbox, and they say, you have received a donation, and they are via PayPal. Now, let me just say real quickly before you jump off that there are people who have donated 2, 3, 4 times. And thank you guys for doing so. So just keep that in mind if you have not donated yet. I'm not trying to press you. I understand if you're poor, but even a $10 drop in the hat is much appreciated and keeps the show going. So all right, let's move on to, I have one social media shout out. It is for the artist Michelle Tomasi. She is at TOMMASI Art, Tomasi Art. So go check her out if you're on Instagram. And let's get to our bad advice of the week, courtesy of Xander Lassen. It's a bad advice triptych, and I think that's how it's going to run for the immediate future. Double success by quadrupling failure, from Michael Eisner. Painting is one of the few things in life for which youth holds no advantage. David Sally, that's from Art Forum. And finally for this week, these are really terrible, rough times, and we should try to be as nice to each other as possible. Lou Reed. Yes, that sentiment is never irrelevant and never goes out of style. We are always, most of us, on the verge of being mean to people, especially in the art world, aren't we? So let's try to keep mindful of that. These are really terribly rough times, and we should try to be as nice to each other as possible. And be bridges. Be bridges, not fortresses, right? I appreciate you guys listening. Thank you so much. I will talk to you next week. We have another international guest next week, believe it or not. So feel free to support the show via social media by becoming a follower on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, the hashtag @artistpodcast. We are also on Snapchat, getting more active there. So if you're on Snapchat, please connect with us there as well. Thanks again. I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.